Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Joseph Brinton, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and by Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in over 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., week-long experiences as well in our Washington, D.C. The Hinckley also offers over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Serious Rules for Nuclear Power Without Proliferation. And I'd like to now turn the time over to Tom Maloney, the director of the Barbara L. and Norman C. Tanner Nonviolent Human Rights Advocacy, to introduce today's speaker, Henry Sokolsky. So please join with me in welcoming Tom.
Thanks very much, and thanks for your patience. I'm Tom Maloney. I'm the director of the Barbara L. and Norman C. Tanner Center for Nonviolent Human Rights Advocacy. And it's our great pleasure to welcome back Henry Sokolsky, who was here with us last spring. Henry is the executive director of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization founded in 1994 to promote a better understanding of strategic weapons proliferation issues among policymakers, scholars, and the media. And he currently serves also as an adjunct professor at the Institute of World Politics in Washington. He previously served as deputy for nonproliferation policy in the Department of Defense, for which he received a medal for outstanding public service. He's the author of a long list, author or editor of a long list of books and other works, including in 2010 the book Nuclear Power's Global Expansion: Weighing Its Costs and Risks. And he's here today to speak with us, as you've heard, about a very timely topic. So timely, I know that he was revising his comments right up to the moment as we were having the students file in. Today's topic, Serious Rules for Nuclear Power Without Proliferation. Henry.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back here again. I have even taken up residence to be able to do this. It doesn't hurt that there's excellent skiing nearby, so I try to avail myself of that when I can. Today, I'm going to give a presentation that is actually the result of 2 years of commissioned research by 20 leading energy and security experts. We held a series of international conferences on the project's aim, and that project aim was to assess how sound current efforts are to prevent the military diversion of nuclear materials from civilian nuclear programs, and to suggest new policies if needed. The recommendations of this project, which you're going to get today, have already been briefed by myself and my co-author, Victor Galinsky, at the State and Defense Departments, at the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, Safeguards Department, key state representatives to the IAEA, and senior nuclear officials in France. It's also been showcased at the Council on Foreign Relations, MIT, Harvard's Belfer Center, Los Alamos National Laboratory. It is not final, and it needs work. One of the reasons I take my work and brief it is to improve it. So your comments and questions today are especially welcome. Before I wrap this project up and I think about a month. We're in the end stretch here. Now, when people think or talk about civilian nuclear energy, the spread of nuclear weapons is rarely high on their list of concerns. I think, instead, nuclear energy programs are generally assessed in terms of their likely economic, environmental, and safety impacts. Yet, for reasons which I will explain today, how closely civilian programs, nuclear energy programs, are tied to the spread of nuclear weapons, and I believe they are going to be increasingly closely tied, is an issue that deserves at least as much attention as the economic, safety, and environmental concerns. If there was to be only one takeaway from today's presentation, it would be this. And to make this point, I'm going to offer three sets of arguments. The first is that the links between civilian and military nuclear programs are likely to be far more important in the future than they've been previously. The second is that our current efforts to prevent military diversions from civilian programs, basically nuclear power programs is what we're talking about, or large research reactor programs. Again, the second point is that our current efforts to prevent military diversions from civilian programs and nuclear proliferation, I think, are inadequate to cope with the risks that we'll run if we continue on our current course, which is to develop and promote nuclear power programs globally. Finally, I'll lay out five minimal principles that I think we are going to have to uphold to correct this mismatch. I also like to perhaps discuss with you in Q&A what the implications might be of failing to support these five principles. And I'm practical enough in my background to know that the likelihood of these principles being seized upon and acted upon is not that high. I think, however, if that's true, that means we may have to think through and more carefully what we are doing to promote nuclear power globally the way we currently are. In any case, as I've already noted, it's environmental, economic, and safety impacts that we tend to focus on when we talk or think about nuclear power and civil nuclear programs in general. We debate if nuclear power plants are a sound investment in regards to the jobs they might create, the cost of the electricity they might produce, or the money their export might secure. After the accidents at Chernobyl so many years ago and more recently at Fukushima, considerable attention now is being paid to how safe these plants might be. And finally, there are environmental issues that we focus on. How critical is the expansion of nuclear power to reduce greenhouse gases and therefore the prospects of global warming? How much of a worry is the disposal of the radiological waste these plants produce? Now, when you think of those questions, in comparison, the question of how closely linked large reactor programs, whether they're power or research programs, are linked to nuclear weapons proliferation is generally not considered an immediate concern. In fact, it's actually treated most by academics, and this is why I'm here. Yeah? The academic community and researchers more generally have been concerned about the link between particularly power reactor programs and nuclear weapons proliferation, I'd say for about a half century. It's a long-lived concern. Now, much of the proliferation that has occurred, nuclear weapons proliferation, has occurred since we acquired our first weapon in 1945, however, has not entirely vindicated the concerns of these people. By the way, I'm one of them, so this is a self-critique. The key reason why is that the early nuclear weapons acquisition efforts of countries like Great Britain, France, Soviet Union, China, Israel, India, and the rest arguably proceeded without these states first developing a serious civilian nuclear power program. The Soviet Union got their bomb in 1949 after basically acquiring their designs from us. They had very good spies. They didn't have a power program. They had a spy program. Russia, in turn, helped China get its first nuclear weapon. And again, China did this without first developing a civilian nuclear energy program. They just simply enriched their uranium, didn't put it in any reactors, and exploded their first bomb. U.S. nuclear weapons designers also arguably played a more than helpful role in the development of French and British nuclear weapons. And the French, we know, were directly responsible for helping Israel get its nuclear weapon. Again, a country that does not have a nuclear power program, and at the time they argued that their reactor was a research reactor, but in fact it was a military production machine at Dimona. Now, of course, there is plenty of evidence that nuclear power and nuclear weapons were linked. I mean, the UK, France, both had plutonium production plants, basically large reactors, that were actually connected to their electrical grid, again, before they acquired their first nuclear weapons. India also had its large research reactor, which we helped supply, connected to the grid before it made the plutonium from that reactor for its first explosion in 1974. In addition, Sweden, Italy, Switzerland all planned to acquire their first bombs from power reactors that they were going to build, and we know all that. But I think, arguably, these historical points don't deserve, or certainly haven't gotten much emphasis, and I think with cause. You know, Italy, Sweden, and Switzerland, after all, did not get nuclear weapons. More important, none of the reactors that were hooked up to the grid that I've mentioned in the UK, France, Russia, and other places were really primarily designed to produce civilian nuclear power. It was just an incidental benefit, and they took advantage of it. Also, many in the nuclear industry are quick to point out that the power reactors deployed today, which are primarily called light water reactors, are far more proliferation resistant than the reactors the UK, France, India, and Russia attached to their grids while making bomb-grade plutonium. They also point out that now almost all of the power reactors operating in countries that lack nuclear weapons are visited regularly by International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors. So this is all different. And so all of this has given rise to the contention that is made by the nuclear industry and many diplomats that the current nuclear power programs hardly present much of a proliferation worry, and that as a consequence, there's hardly much of a need to tighten existing nuclear rules in any significant way. Now, again, what they argue is since past nuclear weapons states relied on covert, dedicated nuclear weapons efforts and did not divert much from their civilian programs, any new weapons state in the future is likely to do the same. Then it's argued, in addition, if we're serious about preventing global warming, we have to support the global spread of nuclear energy. We have no choice. And finally, and sharing such technology is one of the main pillars of the key nonproliferation treaty that controls these matters, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. This is argued by no less of an authority than our Department of State. Now, this general set of arguments is a sort of a view that I and many of the researchers that worked on our project came to find to be unacceptably incorrect, or certainly not one that's worth supporting if we're serious about preventing the spread of nuclear weapons in the future. I think it's worth noting that more than a few experts that want to promote nuclear power to take care of global warming are more than willing to concede that it will take a lot of reactors to do this. You need at least 1,000 new reactors in addition to the ones that we have operating, even to make a slight dent on the greenhouse gas emissions that we currently have and will in the future. This will entail, undoubtedly, dozens of new nuclear power programs in countries that currently have no reactors at all, which has got to raise some security concerns to begin with. But I think, in addition, if you talk to people in the nuclear industry, privately at least, they will concede that there is that we are not even remotely in a position to build that many reactors. either here or abroad. Finally, there really are sounder alternatives, including the increased use of natural gas in place of coal, for reducing carbon emissions at least for the next decade or so, and doing so more cheaply and quickly than a massive and expensive nuclear reactor construction program. Now, second, I think as a practical matter, I don't think there can be any further nuclear weapons proliferation without states diverting some technology or material from their civilian programs. In other words, the future will not be as it's been in the past. It's going to be different. Let me explain why. First of all, now everyone who lacks a nuclear weapon is a member of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And as such, they've all pledged not to acquire nuclear weapons. Now, that has a consequence. By the way, it didn't always used to be. Even 20 years ago, that wasn't the case. But because it's so today, if you will, because of our success in getting them to sign up to this treaty and to ratify it, it means that any non-weapon state that might think about getting nuclear weapons, an Iran, a South Korea, a Turkey, a Japan, a Taiwan, a Saudi Arabia, Egypt, or Algeria, has to break the rules to do so. Now, it's interesting. Those particular countries either have or are seriously planning to get a large nuclear power program. So what that then means that should they decide to get a nuclear weapon, they would have to cheat or withdraw from the NPT. Now, there's been some history since the early 1980s about countries that try to get nuclear weapons that involves bombing. We have the bombing of Iraq's Osirak reactor by the Israelis. The United States bombed Osirak. And then Bushehr was bombed by the Iraqis, which is a power plant. It was declared and peaceful. Because of that history, to say nothing of the Syrian incident where the Israelis bombed it, it was a reactor that was not declared, there is a premium that is going to be placed on transitioning from your decision to make a bomb to getting it very, very quickly. Because in that intervening period when you're acquiring it, you could get hit with a military strike. That means a premium is going to be placed on trying to draw on bomb material and know-how as quickly as possible. And that practically means you're going to resort to what you have. It's a civil program in many cases. The future, again, will not likely be like the past. Now, one of the reasons I had to revise this presentation is there's been some news in the last 48 hours, and it more or less backs up this point. In the Wall Street Journal yesterday, there was an article which you can access if you're a subscriber. I don't know why they did that, but they're rather annoying in that regard. But it's a very important article, and I think there are ways you can get it. What the article was about is we, the United States, sent unmanned air vehicles or drones in large numbers, and the Iranians complained that we were invading their airspace. They complained to the UN. The Wall Street Journal got a hold of the letter that the Iranians sent to the UN, and they discovered something which bothered them, and bothered them because I had been in communication with them about some other development. They connected the dots. It turns out almost all of these drones were flying over or very close to the Bushehr nuclear power plant in Iran. And the question I got when they called about 3 days ago is, why would they do that? I said, well, you know why they would do it, and you know why you're calling me. This is a setup. I had sent them a memo to highlight to their attention, to this particular reporter's attention, that part of the IAEA report that had come just a week before, they have routine reports on the Iran's nuclear program. This report pointed out that all of the fuel in the power reactor at Bushehr had been discharged by the Iranians. That means taken out and put in a spent fuel pond. Now, no one commented on this other than to say, well, they did this. But if you know anything about making plutonium, that was a very alarming event. So I was trying to get the press to pay attention to it. I said, well, wait a minute. It's only been in the reactor, the fuel, for 5 months. Well, why is that a concern? Well, if you take reactor fuel and you run the reactor, I shouldn't say it was in there for 5 months. It was in there seven. But for 5 months, it operated at full capacity. And when you irradiate fuel and you're trying to make power out of it at full capacity for 5 months, you find that the uranium that you put in there, the fresh uranium, transmutes, a certain portion of it transmutes into plutonium. And that plutonium, if you take it out as soon as 5 months, will almost be entirely weapons grade, super for making weapons. That they discharged the fuel at 5 months was alarming because normally they're supposed to discharge the fuel at 12 or 18 months. So the question is, well, why'd they do this? What are they up to? Now, it turns out, shortly after I contacted the press, the former defense secretary, or the secretary for defense in the German defense ministry, his name is Lothar Ruhl, ran a piece in Die Welt, which is their leading newspaper, pointing out that this discharge was very alarming. I did not contact him. I know him, but he figured it out all by himself. Again, it was in Die Welt, but nothing was going on in the American papers. Well, if you take a look at this piece in the Wall Street Journal, they make it very clear that roughly 100 kgs, or kilograms, that's about 25 bombs worth of plutonium was contained in that spent fuel. Iran gave no explanation, as I noted, as to why it discharged the fuel. It's worth noting, no explanation is legally required. I don't have to explain. It's nobody's business but their own. In fact, it turns out that the IAEA is only legally allowed to visit the site once every 90 days. Now, they do have cameras and they have radiation detectors, but they give data feed into a box. And you can't, as an IAEA inspector, go and find out what the box is collecting in the way of information except once every 90 days. That's a long time. And by the way, during that 90 days, you have no idea what's going on in that building. You have none. This is not well understood. I think that explains why we sent UAVs over the Bushehr site. The reason, I think, was that we wanted to make sure that that spent fuel didn't go a-walking, as my wife would say. She's Australian. Where might it go? We're now entering the realm of the paranoid, okay? I don't really think this is what was going to happen or even what they had in mind, per se. I don't know. But it could be moved to a place where you could chemically strip out that plutonium. And such a facility would be easy to hide. To give you some idea, there was a study done in 1977 that was public. It was verified by the General Accounting Office and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Congressional Research Service. It was an argument and a detailed high-fidelity design of a reprocessing plant that could be built in about 6 months, very cheaply, and fit in a room 130 feet by 60 feet by 30. It would throw off no signal until it was operating and could produce its first bomb's worth in about a week, and then a bomb's worth every day thereafter. This kind of cheap, simple reprocessing is not what countries do if they want to commercially reprocess, but it is something you could do. And the worry is they might do it. The Iranians do know how to reprocess. They have a facility they're building at a place called Iraq to do it for a heavy water reactor, which is not completed, but they haven't completed the reprocessing plant either. But they know the chemistry. They know how to do it. And so these UAVs went to check where the IAA might not be able to. And I find all of this very interesting. By the way, today the Russians said and announced, well, we had to discharge the fuel because there were Russians there still. They were about to get ready to hand over this machine. They had helped complete it for the Iranians. We had to do this because we think or thought there were loose bolts in the reactor that could damage the machine. Now, this is the second time they've done this. The first time, the Russians discharged the fuel almost immediately before it even began to operate because of a primary coolant pump breaking up. Now, I am not saying that anyone is lying. Here's the worry. Maybe nobody's lying. But we now have a new normal where shutting a machine off and discharging the fuel is par for the course, even if it contains lots of weapons-grade plutonium. That's not great. The other point is that under the international non-proliferation rules under the NPT, I think the IAEA is wide open for this kind of problem. It's something really would have to be done to change the rules to make clear what this activity is about. It doesn't have the tools to do that. This brings me to the third reason why I think we need to worry about diversions from civilian nuclear programs. And that is that such cheating and withdrawals from the NPT would not be as likely if we had strict measures and penalized violators. But nobody, I think, in all honesty, believes we currently have such strict rules. The NPT allows withdrawal within 90 days. It doesn't define what is permissible under what it calls the right of all nations to develop and have peaceful nuclear energy. There are extreme and, I think, strict limits on what the IAEA can do to ferret out nuclear proliferators and violators. There are no established enforcement mechanisms in the NPT and IAEA. And arguably, the NPT is further undermined by three weapons holdouts, Pakistan, India, and Israel. There remain examples of what you can get away with. Now, when I raise these points with policymakers, and I have, I think they say, well, we would like to upgrade our non-proliferation measures and steps as well, but we have to settle and deal with what we have because global warming is something that requires nuclear energy no matter what. I think that's not quite true for the reasons I've already explained. Then it's argued, well, we have to be in the trade of exporting nuclear power programs and the like, or risk being shut out. If this is the argument, you have to be in the trade to control it. I can't resist. It's not really fair, but I can't resist. This argument's origins comes from the British slave trade. It's a little unfair to make that point because it isn't like there's something morally reprehensible about nuclear power. But the point is it has a history, this argument, and it's never really done very well. In any case, that's argued. But I think there's not a complete thought there. The Russians, for example, sell fairly unsafe machines and finance it. Are we to outbid them on everything? Well, that would mean we'd have to subsidize and give these reactors away. Moreover, it suggests that the United States, which is a pretty important country, is going to lose its seat at the table to negotiate about these things. I don't see that. I mean, we may be, according to some people, in decline, but we are still a very, very important country, I think. Now, finally, there are some people who rightly point out that proliferation is a political problem, and some even argue nothing should be done until we solve these political problems, and it's unfair to lean on countries to tighten up rules that wouldn't inspect them a great deal. I think, however, this ignores that nuclear weapons proliferation is also a technical problem, and I think we have a responsibility to make it difficult for states to acquire these things until we figure out, if we can ever, how to solve the political problems that drive the differences between countries. I mean, I suppose the rough point would be, it really is true that criminals, you know, can, infrequently, they can be reformed, but that doesn't mean we don't buy locks and lock our doors occasionally. I mean, you may want to do both, I think is the point. So what should the U.S. do? I think there are five principles, and these are the ones that we recommend, that should be taken on board. And this, after I get done with the five, I'm done. We'll open up for questions. First, I think withdrawal from the NPT should be made, I think, practically impossible. This sticks in the craw of any lawyer who says, well, all contracts should be have a clause where you can, you know, break the contract, abrogate the treaty. I think we have to start saying that the consequences of nuclear weapons proliferation and is higher increased or higher or more likely use, and that use is an intolerable prospect for civil society. I mean, we've basically spent, I don't know, how many thousands of years trying to figure out how to put people in cities. Well, you know, if a nuclear weapon goes off, then everyone's going to have to head to the hills. It's not just another kind of contract. It's I would argue, it's pretty important not to let people leave, more so than any other contract I can think of. And I think we need to treat that now that way. Now, I think we already sort of make this argument in the case of North Korea. In the case of North Korea, we say, well, they withdrew from the treaty in 2003, but really they can't because they were in violation of the treaty. You can't, you know, leave a contract when you're in violation of it. I mean, any lawyer, you know, will tell you that. But I think we need to go further, and that is even if a country doesn't break any rules and, you know, develops its nuclear program without violating IAEA safeguards, its nuclear program that way, and then decides it wants to get nuclear weapons, I think even it should be held at the door, not allowed out. The reason why is, you know, in a sense, it acquired the know-how to develop the nuclear weapon by promising not to get it and then getting the civil equivalent. And it's the forbearance of folks under the treaty that allowed them to get everything they needed to make the bomb. It doesn't seem right to me that they then should be able to kind of leave, even if they made their weapon arguably indigenously, which is always contentious. I mean, it's or rebuttable. I mean, you know, you could argue that all weapons relate to either us or Nazi Germany or something. I mean, the genealogy of technology is pretty tight. And so the argument that you can do something indigenously never struck me as a very sound argument. Everything's related to previous efforts. Now, practically, I think what this means is I think you'd have to make sure that all facilities that are under IAEA safeguards stay under IAEA safeguards. It's not well known, but if you withdraw from the NPT, you're allowed to stop all inspections. Now, that doesn't sound right. It seems to me that even if you withdraw, all the facilities should still be under those IAEA inspections. The second principle is we need to limit access to nuclear explosive materials. This is highly enriched uranium and plutonium. Now, President Obama is certainly spotlighted American efforts to eliminate use of highly enriched uranium for civilian purposes. He's trying to take the material back, blend it down, work with other countries to do that. But I think, in addition, we ought to just simply say you should not strip out plutonium from the spent fuel either. And the reason why is it's unnecessary for waste management. It is uneconomical to do so. It's just unnecessary. Everyone can agree to that. We don't do it. No one else should either. And it isn't just because we don't do it, but it's because nobody should be doing it, including us. Now, the reason you would want to really put restrictions on the generation of this material, these materials, and its and their possession is you can't really inspect anyone who has these materials or is producing them in a way that would allow you to get warning early enough to prevent them from quickly moving them into a nuclear weapons device. And so you can't really promote nonproliferation and have these materials being produced, particularly in non-weapons states. Now, I think the real problem here is that you need low-enriched uranium, slightly enriched uranium, to have nuclear power. How we deal with this is a big issue. I'm not pretending I have the answers here. Better be done in a non-discriminatory way. It has to be somehow a principle that everyone can agree to, including the weapon states and the non-weapon states. A start towards this kind of world, however, would be to inflict a fee on everyone that is making these materials. Now, it isn't because you can get inspections that would safeguard against diversions, but it would increase the amount of inspections to at least deter diversion better. By the way, the fee should be should cover the cost, therefore it will be very expensive. And I think it should be equal for all facilities, no matter what their size, since the danger is not in relation to size. It's in relation to the activity. The third principle would be to expand inspections. I think now we know if we want to prevent diversions, if we want to prevent proliferation, we're going to have to prevent not only diversions from declared sites, but covert activities. More special inspections. This is something we learned from the IAEA they legally could do, but there hasn't been political will to do. We need to start instituting what I would call near real-time or real-time inspections, where you have a data feed to that camera or a data feed to that sensor that will feed back to headquarters in Vienna so people know every 5 minutes whether the lights have been turned out or there's a crane in front of the camera or, holy cow, they're stealing something. We have this voluntarily in place for about a third of the declared sites. I think we need to just say, got to do it for all the sites. Then I think we need to actually move to much more routine inspections. Fourth, ensure enforcement. Now, President Obama at the UN in 2009 said there ought to be immediate consequences for violators or people who withdraw from the NPT. How, though? Take a look at how long it took us to get any kind of sanctions on Iran. It took about a decade. Or 5 years, take your pick. But it was more than a few weeks. In the case of North Korea, it also took a very long time. So one of the suggestions of the former deputy directors of the IAEA for safeguards was to put default automatic country-neutral sanctions into place at the UN Security Council. Might even want to have a secretariat to enforce this. And the sanctions could be quite modest. They don't have to be draconian in the beginning, but something that puts the country in a penalty box. Countries really do not want to be there. Iran is very concerned about its legal status as a country, whether it's a violator. It's quite interesting. You know, if they were really outlaws, they wouldn't care. They sort of care. I think they're trying to get the bomb, but they care about not being caught out. Okay, finally, bring non-members into the NPT. This is sort of the most woolly-headed thing I have on my list. So pay close attention. I think non-weapon states are unlikely to agree to any of the tightening that I've described in these other principles unless there are more nuclear weapons reductions. This means not just the United States and not just the United States and Russia, but China, France, the UK, and, yes, the non-members. That would be now North Korea, Pakistan, India, and Israel. You have to universalize the treaty. I mean, we did this sort of with anti-slavery laws. We universalized the treaty. Some countries had not signed. We still apply it to them. I think we need to do that here. Some say we're not in the treaty, so we shouldn't have to be inflicted with the rules. But I think what we should say is you're in, you may be in noncompliance, and here are some steps you can take to move closer and closer to full compliance. I think this is going to be very tough to do, but we are in a form of denial about this almost entirely, which I think is not that difficult to remedy. To give you an example, our government does not even recognize that Israel has nuclear weapons. I mean, we could just say, yeah, they have nuclear weapons. I mean, Israel, for a lot of reasons, may not want to say it has them, and that's fine, but we as a government could at least say that. I think I'm going to end right there and open it up for questions, but Those are the principles, and I think if you can't get those principles supported, it probably makes pushing nuclear power to more and more countries something you may want to rethink. Okay, so let's open it up.
And as you said, we'll devote the remainder of our time to questions from the audience. So if you have a question, please state your name, speak clearly into the microphone, and a little bit about yourself.
Hello. My name is Stephen Goodwill, and I am a freshman at the University of Utah. And I had some questions concerning what do you think the U.S.'s appropriate response to Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon would be? Because we've talked about the possibility of them acquiring a nuclear weapon. But do you what do you believe the consequences of their acquisition of a nuclear weapon would be, and what do you think the U.S.'s appropriate response would be?
Well, at a minimum, I would treat such an event more sternly than we did the first time around when North Korea got it. There, we kind of blinked and said, "Well, you know, there's not much we can do," and then we waited for missile launches to sort of impose some kinds of sanctions. I think we should, you know, if that happens, the immediate response should be to put it in a penalty box, much like we did in South Africa, and say, well, you're not really, you know, a member of the IAEA anymore until you give this stuff up. You're not a member of the NPT until you give this stuff up. You're not to serve even on certain UN bodies as an equal anymore until you give this up. And this is the treatment South Africa got. So at a minimum, I would do that. As a practical matter, I think you're going to have to make sure that the neighbors don't follow that model. And you're going to have to do an awful lot of reassurance, economically and militarily, to the neighbors not to follow in suit. I think in particular, China and Pakistan have to be told, you're not to transfer nuclear weapons to Saudi Arabia. That actually is legal under the NPT, as long as they stay under the control of the grantor of the weapon. I think we need to probably start thinking about that now. But roughly, you're going to have to wait them out, something like a Cold War. I mean, we're sort of in a Cold War with Iran now. It would intensify. What you don't want is a hot war.
Hi, my name is Matthew Stern. I'm a senior here at the U. And I'd like to get your thoughts on the Price-Anderson agreement here domestically and the idea that our domestic nuclear energy production is not really as cheap as it's sold to be when you consider the massive taxpayer subsidy on the liability end of that.
Well, Price-Anderson is a law that was passed in 1957 that said we are going to put a cap on the liability for off-site damages in the case of a nuclear accident. And the U.S. government essentially will step in and take up the slack for what would be billions of dollars worth of damage. Of course, in those days, we didn't think it would be quite that high. Now, that was supposed to last for no more than 10 years. So that would be 57, 67. It's gone on quite a long time further. Fukushima now has generated an expenditure, according to the Japanese government, of $67 billion. There are estimates that it'll be double to triple that before they get done. Now, we have in place about several hundred million dollars that's in reserve, and then if there's an accident, up to about roughly $12 billion would be taken from the vendors if the Secretary of Energy decides that that's appropriate. If he says, well, that's too much of a burden, then it would just be taken out of the Treasury. The big point here is the figure is off by an order of magnitude. It should be closer to $120 billion by now, given what we now know about Fukushima. The reason why is the damage isn't so much people whose health is ruined or people who have died. It's the evacuation. And if there's an evacuation near an urban area, the costs are enormous because the property values go to zero. And the property capital is enormous, and compensating people for that is an astronomical figure. More important, I think you can't promote nuclear power effectively, and you certainly can't export, unless the insurance that is needed to cover this liability is something that the nuclear power vendors are themselves able to assume. Right now, there are virtually no American reactor exports because legally the exposure to being sued is too risky. So at some point, I think we ought to say, well, Price Anderson's going to go away. You need to start putting money aside to self-insure. If the industry did that, it would then be able to export. Right now, we're trying to get the Indians, for example, to say, we won't sue you in the case of a nuclear accident. And the problem is there's history there. There was an accident, I believe it was in the early 80s, at Bhopal, Union Carbide, and it killed at least 3,000 or more people. And the company folded, and nobody collected any damages. The Indians remember that. And they're not, I suspect it's going to be very difficult to get them to say, oh, well, in the case of nuclear, we'll be happy to let you off the hook and not ever sue you. So it's a serious issue. Yeah.
My name's Abigail Schwendeman. I'm a freshman here at the U. I'm just curious about Iran, especially with the newest updates in the last 48 hours. So, I mean, what is the likelihood of them trying to create a nuclear weapon at this point? Is it a matter of not if, but when, or is it?
Well, let me reassure you on this case dealing with the spent fuel. They put it back in the reactor. So, I think a lot of people go, and then they just proceed as if nothing happened. You know, my take is, yeah, it wasn't that likely, but boy, that's a hell of a precedent, and, we ought to be focusing on that. With regard to, the question of when versus if, I'm only a mortal. I assume the worst of these folks, but they certainly have taken their time. I mean, if they wanted to get a crude device, they could have done it by now. They seem to be working on a pretty advanced design, not a crude design, and they seem to be taking their time. I think there are a lot of downsides to testing a device or coming out. And they are reaping the benefits of being, if you will, a virtual nuclear state. So, they may go for quite a while. But I suspect with these things, ultimately it's like a 14-year-old in certain temptations. Being diplomatic, they may have to. They just be irresistible at some point. And that's the problem. What you've got to hope for is that the current set of people running that place are ushered off the stage. When that'll happen, I don't know. That's it. That's all she wrote. Oh, no, here we go.
My name is Gretchen Gibson. I'm a junior here at the U.
Yeah.
I guess my question is more what consequences are actually put in place as of right now for states that choose to withdraw from the treaty?
Not much. Essentially, if you read the treaty, and by the way, if you read it, you'll be an expert, instant expert. It takes about 5 minutes. I don't know that anybody who works this field has bothered to read it. But if you do, you can come to Washington and be an assistant secretary, maybe. I'm kidding, but you should take a look at the treaty. It's pretty clear. The consequences are not built into the treaty. You will have a right to withdraw, and you are supposed to give your reasons. But that's pretty much it. And you'll find both Republicans and Democrats arguing, well, we don't want to change that because we want to have the right to withdraw from all treaties. And if we say that, they can't withdraw from this one, well, then it'll have knock-on effects for all the treaties we might want to withdraw from. And I think there's a lack of imagination. Maybe you don't say you can't withdraw, but you make it practically very, very difficult along the lines I said. Right now, it's pretty easy.
Hans Erber, Economics Department.
Yeah.
I think you accept the fact too quickly that nuclear power is necessary for combating climate change.
By the way, was there another speaker here? You two easily accept a straw man. I said explicitly that there are cheaper alternative ways of dealing with global warming and without using nuclear power. So you're arguing against a different speaker than I. I think we're in agreement, I'm afraid.
You're trying to do something impossible, which is that's how I see it. With all your intelligence, you're trying to do something which is impossible, namely eliminate nuclear weapons without eliminating nuclear power.
I think, again, a different speaker was up here. I thought I was very clear that these are minimal principles. They're going to be difficult, maybe impossible, to implement, and if so, the case for going ahead with nuclear power is, I think, ought to be weakened to the point of, you know, not going ahead. So, again, I'm afraid we're in agreement again.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Steve Bannister, I'm a grad student in economics. So let's play the magic game that we could replace the need for nuclear for power generation with something that was acceptable environmentally.
Yeah.
Is there sufficient need on the, I guess, the medical isotope and whatever research needs, just supporting those, would that be enough to, you know, make you worry about transferring that into a weapon-grade program, or is it such low level?
I think there are two comments. First, I think you caught the essence. You should be able to produce your isotopes without having a large reactor. And so the amount of warning you would have of creating a bomb's worth in one of these smaller, lower-powered machines would be like a decade. That's timely. That's more than enough. So I'm not wild about really large research reactors, but I think you don't need them. So that's point one. I think point two, to an extent that is interesting, and this place, being such a medical center, could probably speak to it better than I, in a heartbeat, no pun intended. The reliance on chemo to deal with certain pathologies is going down. I personally experienced this recently. Immunology protocols are taking the place of a lot of things. And so while there's still a very important need for these things, it isn't as broad a bandwidth of things as it used to be. It's narrowing. So I don't know if that helps, but I think we can manage that properly and easily. By the way, there are certain reactors I don't know that are that much of a problem. I mean, if you had a zero-power research reactor, that's okay. I mean, I don't know that should be the kind of thing that we're going after. Those are research reactors. You find them at MIT and a couple other places. Oh, there's one here. There you go.
I have a question next, if I may. I think a lot of people saw the recent graph or picture that was printed in a lot of major newspapers, outlined the energy output from a nuclear explosion. There was some Farsi writing at the bottom, and they said it had come from Iran, and it was a plan to make a nuclear weapon.
Oh, wow. Well, I think you're ahead of me. you'll have to text me.
I will. It seems like a lot of people are scared about Iran getting a nuclear weapon, and this the graph that was shown. Is stuff like this credible? Would the media get something like this?
Yeah. Look, I think the takeaway, if we're thinking clearly, is we should be concerned about just about anybody getting a nuclear weapon. It shouldn't just be Iran. And I think there is a desire on the part of many diplomats to focus on certain countries that we don't get along with and say, you know, they're the problem. I think the problem's broader. And within limits, we have to think about our role in this as well. But, Iran's a problem. I'm willing to concede that right away. No problem at all.
Hi, my name's Tim Scoglin. I live in Salt Lake City.
Yes.
I've read that there's some fourth generation nuclear power plants in the offing that supposedly have really high burn up rates.
Yes.
And they could actually consume, spent fuel, depleted uranium, everything. And I was wondering if that figures into your non-proliferation plans.
After you look at fourth generation reactors, you're really eager to see what the fifth generation will be. And the reason why is those reactors that you're talking about employ what's called fast neutrons. Okay. Right. And it's basically sodium-cooled fast reactor systems that you're talking about, variants of thereof. And let's just say that with some mild tweaking, you get things that are ideal weapons production plants, and the technology is not that different. I think if we're serious about nuclear power, some of us aren't, but for those who are, we need to talk to them too, right? And there are plenty of people who are. I think you're going to see a pause right now. I think nuclear power may not grow very much, may not grow at all for about a decade or more. This is the time you want to think about designing reactors that really step up to several criteria. Be nice if the fuel didn't melt. By the way, there are some designs where they don't melt. The fuel doesn't melt. It would be nice if they actually were affordable. That's a big problem. None of this stuff, as best I can tell, is anywhere close to economic. Even the small ones, when you do the calculations of the price per kilowatt, installed kilowatt hour, are off the charts. Finally, it would be nice if they never were refueled. And there are designs. General Atomics have some of them. I think we need to kind of push ourselves, if we're really serious about promoting nuclear power, to a higher level of criteria for safety against accidents and proliferation. And I would add immediately, it better be cost effective. And if it isn't, forget it. I don't care whether it meets the other two criteria.
I'm Tim Chambliss. I teach in political science. My question is about the Cheney doctrine, the Cheney 1% doctrine, and the role activities of non-state actors who feel unconstrained by the United Nations or by treaty agreements. What is your response?
Well, I'm not sure I know what the 1%.
The Cheney doctrine, 1% doctrine?
The Cheney 1%. It sounds... I've heard about the 1%, but I didn't hear about the Cheney 1%. So
maybe call it the 1% doctrine or the Cheney doctrine, that if there's a 1% chance that non-state actors can acquire nuclear weapons, then we have to act as if it's a certainty.
I think that's not right. I say this as a Republican and someone who voted for Mr. Cheney and worked for him. Okay. I think that is not right for a couple of reasons. First of all, you cannot let the most remote possibility drive day-to-day policy. I have someone very close to me who worries about asteroid attacks. The odds right now of a terrorist being able to pull off a nuclear explosion are not quite like the asteroid attack, although, by the way, I've read up on asteroid attacks. They're more likely than I thought. The problem is it's not even 1%. There's interest. There's rhetoric. And it certainly has gotten us locked in. I believe there was a report on Cheney's watch that New York Harbor might get vaporized. And they took it very seriously. It turned out to be a hoax. That was one of the reasons it was easy to say, well, we have to go after Saddam and enter into a war. I'm not sure. Maybe if we took a little more time, we would have waged that war differently, or maybe we wouldn't have. So you want to be careful about having the 1% drive the 99% of policy. And you particularly want to be careful if the 1% is not even 1%. We did certain things during the Cold War based on the 1% possibility of certain things happening with the Russian arsenal flying our way. We ended up with 35,000 nuclear weapons, and we had to walk that back and figure out how to rationalize it, and luckily we did. Again, I'm not saying we shouldn't have fought the Cold War, But your ability to do things smart depend on the absence of abject fear running you hard. And you do not want to surrender to that, ever.
And that's the conclusion of today's Sinkley Forum. So let's give a round of applause to our guests for an excellent panel.